to recap where we're up to, and then we'll continue from where we left off. We discussed the laws of Muktzah. We started off by saying that the laws of Muktzah are simply a Isser Dirabbanan. They are only a rabbinic prohibition. You look through all of Chumash, nowhere will you find that the laws of Muktzah are written. Nowhere will you find that those are documented. So this is an Isser Dirabbanan that was instituted either in the days of David HaMelech or in the days of Nehemiah. Now, naturally, one should have said that whenever you have an Isser Dirabbanan, whenever one is in doubt, whenever one has a suffix about an Isser Dirabbanan, generally the assumption is that suffix Dirabbanan lekula, one has the right to be lenient. However, Muktzah seems to be somewhat of an anomaly. Muktzah seems to be somewhat unusual. We waited for you. Muktzah seems to be somewhat unusual that by Muktzah we find that even a suffix Muktzah, we go l'chumra. The Shulchan Aruch says this is an unusual kind of circumstance that even though we're dealing only with an Isser Dirabbanan, still when a person is in doubt about one of the laws of Muktzah, one has to err on the side of caution. And this is why it's important for us to familiarize ourselves with what falls under the categories of Muktzah and what perhaps might not. We discussed last week as well that the Rambam gives us a whole list of reasons why the Chachamim felt it necessary to institute the laws of Muktzah. I would have said Shabbos was difficult enough as is without Muktzah being part of the difficulty of Shabbos. We had enough to worry about on Shabbos without worrying about what we're allowed to touch or handle. Why was it necessary? What was the impetus for this whole idea of Muktzah? And the answer the Rambam tells us is for a number of reasons. Number one, says the Rambam, because we need what we refer to as a Shvisa Hanikeres B'Shabbos. We want that Shabbos should be obvious and recognizable to anyone that sees you. They should be able to notice immediately that today is Shabbos. And the most obvious way to do that is by people noticing that you're not handling the items that you would normally handle during the week. That is reason number one. Reason number two, the Rambam says, he gives a number of reasons, but the Gemara also tells us the reason why is because we have a biblical prohibition of hotza'ah on Shabbos. You're not allowed to carry something outside without an eruv. What is one very easy way to make sure that people don't mistakenly carry something outside without an eruv? Well, the answer to that is make sure that they limit the amount of items that they handle on Shabbos altogether. So therefore, this was in some way a safeguard to make sure nobody violates something which is far worse. So we made a safeguard by stopping them from handling regular items in the first place. So that is with regard to the reasons behind why Muktzah was instituted. Now you'll see in a minute why that's important. And again, we're just reviewing in order that we can have a better understanding of what we're going to discuss today. The Shulchan Aruch says, let's go through the categories of Muktzah. So first of all, what would not fall under the categories of Muktzah? What certainly would be permissible to use on Shabbos and handle on Shabbos? Number one, the Shulchan Aruch tells us, Kisvei HaKodesh, if you have a Sefer Torah, if you have a Navi, if you have any Sefer, any book that you think will enhance your spirituality on Shabbos, that is something that is certainly permissible on Shabbos. Even though it's up on top of the bookshelf somewhere and you haven't looked at it in 20 years, doesn't make a difference. If it's something that is what we call Kisvei HaKodesh, that is certainly permissible to use on Shabbos and encouraged to be used on Shabbos. Shabbos is supposed to be spent doing spiritual things. And Shabbos, the Gemara says, Lo nitnu shabbosos ela lasuk behem b'divrei Torah. That's what the Beis Yosef quotes in Hilchos Shabbos, that Shabbos is really meant for these kinds of activities. So that is number one, that Kisvei HaKodesh are certainly encouraged to be used on Shabbos, and there is no prohibition of Muktzah that applies to them at all. Secondly, we have all food items that are edible are certainly allowed to be used on Shabbos. And that means not only something that I enjoy eating, it means something that a regular person would eat. So let's say we have peanut butter in the house, and I happen not to enjoy peanut butter, or I'll never eat it, or I'm allergic to it. Since that's something which is normal for regular people to use, that would not be considered anything that is muktzah at all. That is certainly something that is allowed to be handled. There's an interesting discussion, what about on Pesach, when I have certain items that I myself would never eat, but for other people they would. For example, let's say you have, we know that the Svardim very often don't follow the laws of kidneys on Pesach. So what would you say if an Ashkenazi has or sees kidneys around? Would you say that that is muktzah? Well, after all, it is a food item. It's not permissible for me, but it is permissible for other people. So would you say that that is considered something that is muktzah or not? The Chazon Ish writes, that is absolutely permissible because it is a food item and it's not something that only strange people eat, it's something that regular people eat if they have the ability to do so. So if someone is a Sephardi and they follow that rule, which allows them to eat kidneys on Pesach, even an Ashkenazi would be allowed to handle such food on Shabbos. That would not be considered to be a violation of Muktzah. The next category that the Shulchan Aruch spoke about was Klei HaSeuda, any utensils, any cutlery that might be used for the purposes of a meal on Shabbos, would certainly not fall under the category of Muktzah at all and would be permissible to be used on Shabbos. That is not an issue at all. So those are the general things that the Shulchan Aruch says are absolutely permissible, nothing to worry about at all. However, the Shulchan Aruch then goes into a discussion about certain items which are not permissible. And this is important for us to know, and to know clearly what are the categories and where do certain items fall under these categories, because the rules change. And this is a little bit complicated before you hear our shiur, but after you go through our shiur, it should be very clear to everyone. If there's anything that's not clear, please make sure to raise the question. So let's begin. The first category that we spoke about was something that we refer to as muktzah machmas chisaron kis. When you have something which is an expensive item or difficult to get another one of, even if it's not expensive. So for example, the common example that the Shmir Shabbos Kilchasa gives for our generation is if you have a license or you have a credit card or you have a passport, which is a big hassle to get a new one, even though it might not cost you a lot of money, but it's a pain in the neck. You have to cancel all of your subscriptions to everywhere and you have to change everything over. All your accounts have to be switched over and you have to order a new one. All of those are considered to be muktzah machmas chisaron kis. If I have my violin, it's an expensive item. I don't want people playing with it. I don't want people touching it on Shabbos. It's going to get ruined. Something of that nature is in this category of muktzah machmas chisaron kis. And this is considered to be a very serious category of muktzah. What we mean by that is you are not allowed to move it for any purpose at all. Even if my credit card is left in the middle of the table, even if my license is left in the middle of the table, even if I didn't do it, my children took my wallet and left it on the table. Something like that is considered to be totally off limits on Shabbos. You are not allowed to move it even though it's in the way. Even though there's a plate that needs to be put down there, even though someone needs to sit at the table, all of that is considered to be totally off limits on Shabbos and you are not allowed to handle it at all. The only way you can handle that is in the following way. The Shulchan Aruch gives us three ways. Number one, if you have a non-Jew available in your house anyway, you can ask the non-Jew directly to move the muktzah item out of the way if you need that place. There is no prohibition of Amira Lanachri. There's no prohibition of asking a non-Jew to move it because there's no real malacha involved. I'm not allowed to ask a non-Jew to do malacha for me, but this is not a real malacha. This is just handling muktzah. Well, he's not obligated by the laws of handling muktzah, there's nothing wrong with him doing it. So the Shulchan Aruch says, if there is a need, you're allowed to have a non-Jew move it out of the way for you in order that your Shabbos will be enhanced. That is number one. Number two, the Shulchan Aruch says, another way to get around this problem would be either to do tiltul min hatzad, which means you indirectly get rid of the item from the table. So it means either you pick up the tablecloth and push it off, or you pick up the whole table itself and push the item off. Now, what if we have a credit card which is on the table, and I don't really want to pick up the tablecloth and just shake it off because now it's going to be on the floor and then my kids are going to get to it. So what do I gain by pushing it onto the floor? It's still going to be the same problem. Well, the Shulchan Aruch says you're also allowed to pick up the whole table and move it to a place where you can knock off the credit card. Now, that's not so relevant if you're talking about a dining room table. You can't move it. So what would be the classic case that we're dealing with? I didn't say classical, I said classic. I made the mistake last night. So what would be the classic case of moving it off the table in the proper way when you don't want it to be on the floor? You can push over the table, have the credit card fall on the floor, but now that it's on the floor, you have the second heter that the Shulchan Aruch gives, and that is tiltul baguf, that a person has the right to move the item with a different part of their body than the way they would normally handle it. So as long as you're not taking the muktzah with your hands, but you're doing it either with your elbow or you're kicking it with your foot, that is something that would be permissible if this credit card is somewhere where it shouldn't be, or it's getting in the way of your Shabbos, or it's something that is bothering you that it's around the house and not in a proper place. That is something that we would allow. So again, we have this very serious category of muktzah, which we refer to as muktzah machmas chisaron kis. That is category number one, something which is expensive, something which is difficult to get another one of, to replace. Anything of that nature, we would say, is totally off limits. You're not allowed to move it, even if it's in your way, even if it's an inconvenience. The only way you could do it is three ways. Either you have a non-Jew move it for you, you can have tiltul min hatzad, you can move it indirectly, which means, many achronim say, that doesn't mean you could just take a fork and move it with your hand via the fork. It has to be some other indirect way, either by picking up the table or by picking up the tablecloth, something like that, and making it move out of the way. Or number three, you can do tiltul baguf. You can use a part of your body that is not the normal part of the body that you would use to handle this item. That's with regard to the first category of muktzah. The second category we spoke about is what we call muktzah machmas gufo, something which has absolutely no purpose on Shabbos, which would include eitzim v'avanim v'afar, when you have dirt, when you have rocks, when you have sand, something of that nature that just has no purpose on Shabbos. Those are all considered to be muktzah and fall under the same rules as the first category. You're not allowed to move them for anything. So if your kids go outside into the backyard and very politely bring back all the rocks from your backyard or your front yard and put them in the middle of the dining room table, that is something you certainly don't want, but it's something you can't do anything about. How can you handle that? Either you can pick up your table and have the rocks fall off on their own, which might break something. You can have a non-Jew move them, or you can move it with your arm or your leg or something of that nature and get them out of the way in that fashion. But generally, we assume this is also considered to be something which is very problematic on Shabbos. Anything which has no purpose on Shabbos, we consider that to be muktzah. Now, when you have something which is designated for the use, for a proper use on Shabbos, that is something that would be permissible. So let's say you have sand, we said is generally muktzah. But if you have a sandbox which is designated for children to play in on Shabbos, we assume that certainly would get you around the issue of muktzah. There would be no problem at all. If you have, let's say the Shulchan Aruch says, anything which is dangerous, so you have shards of glass all over the floor because something smashed all over the place, that would not be muktzah, even though the glass has no purpose. There's nothing I'm going to do with all these broken pieces. But because it is in some way a sakana, because it is dangerous, Shulchan Aruch says muktzah doesn't apply to any dangerous scenario either. Another example that the Shulchan Aruch gives of something which is muktzah, and this is going to be controversial, but it shouldn't be, is something which is balei chayim. Live animals, the Shulchan Aruch says, are muktzah. Those are off limits on Shabbos. There was a major question because in the days of the Shulchan Aruch, there was no such thing as a pet. They didn't have pets like we have today. The animals that they had were not living in their homes. The animals that they had were not like the relationship that many people have with animals today. So the question was raised, should we assume that now, when you have an animal which is of different nature than the original animals that the Shulchan Aruch is describing, should we assume that the nature of animals has changed so much, our relationship with them, that now the Shulchan Aruch's assumption is no longer correct? Again, the Shulchan Aruch says the reason why animals are muktzah on Shabbos is because they have no purpose. But now animals do have a purpose, because animals can sometimes relax somebody, animals can make them feel good. Maybe we should assume that the status of animals changes. So in fact, the Tosis writes in Maseches Shabbos that there was an opinion of one of the Balei HaTosis, Rabbi Yosef Porat, who was of the opinion, one of the French Balei HaTosis, who said that when you have a bird that is going to chirp, and if you bring it somewhere, it's going to be able to calm a baby down, to soothe a baby who is going out of control, that is something that he felt would be permissible on Shabbos. Why? Because he said, that's not an animal that has no purpose. That does have a purpose. If that's the way the kid is going to go to sleep, by hearing the bird sing or the bird chirp, that would be something that is permissible. But his opinion was outvoted. His opinion was not accepted, and the Shulchan Aruch does not like that opinion at all. And the Shulchan Aruch assumes that animals are considered to be muktzah. What about animals of today? What about our animals that we generally use today? So it was pretty much unanimous. Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Reb Moshe Feinstein and Reb Avadi Yosef and all the great gedolim of the last generation felt that animals fall under the same category as they always did. Even though the nature of our relationships with animals have certainly changed, and pets are something that were never around 500 years ago, it's not a concept that was around, still, we assume that the nature of the prohibition of muktzah still applies to an animal on Shabbos. And somebody asked last night, what about the fact that the animal is in pain over the fact that I'm not giving the animal a hug? What about the fact that the animal is trying to get me to show affection to it on Shabbos, and it's something that is going to make the animal uncomfortable? It's a good question. The problem is that the Shulchan Aruch says, Tzar Balei Chaim would not be a right for us to violate the laws of Shabbos. Shabbos is Shabbos. It doesn't mean we don't value animals. It just means we value Shabbos more than the animals. However, the Shemira Shabbos Kilchasa writes that one certainly would be, if there's an Eruv, one would be allowed to walk an animal on Shabbos. That would not be considered to be a malacha because you're not handling the animal. All you're doing is handling the leash, which is not muktzah at all. There's nothing wrong with touching that and with walking the dog because the dog really walks on its own. Yeah. Seeing eye dog, Reb Shlomo Zalman spoke about, and he said, obviously, if you have a seeing eye dog, that's something that is necessary for one's health. So the laws of muktzah, the same way they don't apply to something which is dangerous, like the shards of glass on the floor, the seeing eye dog, he felt there's enough room to assume that there's nothing to be concerned about. Or I would say the same. I didn't see Rav Shlomo Zalman say this. I don't want to speak for him. But I would say that if you have somebody who has a psychological imbalance, and certainly the animal will give them some kind of refuah on Shabbos. And we know in the hospitals all the time, they bring animal therapy and they do that. So even if you're not in the hospital, but you have somebody who has a problem and the animal will certainly help them out, that would be, I think, also under this category of what we would consider to be permissible on Shabbos. But generally, most people who have pets in the house are not for those purposes. Most people who have pets in the house are either just for companionship or because they enjoy having the animal around or the animal enjoys being with them, whatever it might be, and it's a very nice thing to do. But we have to worry about the laws of Shabbos. Having animals in general causes a lot of, you have to think about a lot of halachic challenges. Not impossible to have an animal, not impossible to have a pet, but there are many halachic challenges that come up now that the advent of pets has become much more common. For example, how do we deal with neutering the animal? That's something that is a iser d'oraisa. The Gemara says you're not allowed to neuter an animal. And how do we deal with that? Nowadays, we don't generally have pets in the house that are not neutered. Otherwise, they're going to be wild and they're not going to be domesticated. So there are a lot of issues. How do we deal with animals and pets? They're workable. We can deal with them, but you have to figure out how to deal with them. We'll talk about that some other time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what?
You can drop it on the floor with your elbow, and then you can kick it with your foot. Yeah, that's called tilta bagufa, which doesn't fall under the laws of mukta. So animals is something to be aware of. Animals is something to be careful about, and it's something I think many people are probably not too careful about. Another thing that falls into that category of something which is mukta machmas gufo, something which has no purpose on Shabbos, is raw food. Uncooked food, which you cannot cook on Shabbos. So, for example, you have a potato. So your kids are playing in the closet, in the whatever it might be, in the pantry, and now they're throwing potatoes all over the floor. Maybe only my kids do, but sometimes you have potatoes that end up in places where they shouldn't be. So something like that we assume to be muktzah. Once again, you would be allowed to move it with your leg to get it out of the way because you don't want it in the middle of the kitchen. You'd be allowed to move it with something else to kick it out of the way. But to pick up the potato with your hands and put it back where it belongs is something that is muktzah because the potato is not edible. I was thinking last night, let's say often we buy avocados and the avocados are hard like a rock. You're not going to eat them that way. That would also fall under the same category. That's like a potato. That's not edible the way it is. You need it to ripen. You need it to become edible. You need it to become fit for human consumption. However, when you have something which is frozen, that is not considered to be muktzah. Something frozen is considered to be edible because you can just take it out of the freezer and let it thaw out. Which means even when it's 5 minutes before the end of Shabbos and there's no way this can thaw out, so you'll say maybe now it becomes muktzah. No, that's not the case. Because if something throughout the duration of Shabbos would have been edible, had you only taken it out early enough, then we assume that for the entire duration of Shabbos, even when it's unreasonable that it can possibly be thawed out, we still would consider that to be permissible on Shabbos. That is not muktzah at all. So anything from the freezer that is already cooked and just frozen, even if you had no plans on eating it at all, that would be something that is considered to be non-muktzah on Shabbos. However, when you have raw meat in the freezer, which cannot be eaten raw, we're not talking about a hot dog, which some people do eat raw. We're talking about some kind of steak that certainly nobody, I think most people, would not eat a regular steak raw from the freezer. Something like that we consider to be muktzah, which one has to be careful about because when you set up your freezer and you put your dessert or your ice cream in there and you want to take it out, one has to be mindful about the fact that you might have muktzah items in the way that have to be moved out of your way. So before Shabbos, you should think about that. Or as we mentioned last week, if you have the new freezers which have a drawer that pulls out, it means every time you're pulling the drawer and you're trying to get your ice cream out of the freezer, you might also be pulling out all of the raw meats that are in that drawer as well. One has to be thoughtful about that and careful about where exactly you place things in the freezer and what you're going to do about the muktzah items that might be in there on Shabbos. So that is something that we need to think about as well. The third category we discussed is what we refer to as a kli shemelachto le'iser, which means something which is generally used for a prohibited purpose. However, on Shabbos, I want to use it for something permissible. For example, the general example that is given is a hammer. If you normally use a hammer to do some sort of malacha on Shabbos, you do it normally to bang a nail into the wall, or you use a screwdriver to screw something into the wall, which you're not allowed to do on Shabbos, that's what we refer to as a kli shemalachto le'isur. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with it, but now I want to use it for a permissible purpose on Shabbos. For example, I want to use it to crack my coconut. So if that's the normal way to crack a coconut, to take your hammer and to smash the top of the coconut open, that would be considered something which is a kli shemalachto le'isur that I now want to use for a permissible purpose. Something like that, the rule goes as follows. I'm allowed to move a hammer or a screwdriver if it's, number one, something that is tzorach gufo. I want to use it for a permissible purpose on Shabbos, like cracking the coconut. Or if it's tzorach makomo, if it's something that I need the space, meaning we mistakenly left the hammer in the middle of the dining room table. Now, the hammer is not intrinsically wrong. There's nothing wrong with it. It's not an electrical circuit. There's nothing wrong with it. But the hammer is something that we generally use for a prohibited purpose. Now it's in the middle of my dining room table. That's what we refer to as tzorach makomo. I need this space, and because I need this space, I'm allowed to move it. That doesn't mean you kick it off the table. It doesn't mean you push it off with your arm. It means you're allowed to pick it up directly with your hands and move it away from the place where it is. Once you're allowed to move it away for that purpose because you need the space on the table or because it's hindering your enjoyment of Shabbos by seeing that in the middle of the table, even if no one needs to sit there, but it bothers you to be there, we assume you don't have to just pick it up and drop it right next to you. You're allowed to pick it up and move it to a place where you think it's going to be comfortable, where you think it's not going to be in your way, even if that means going to another room, even if it means going somewhere else in the house, that would be something that we would permit. So when we're dealing with a kli shemalachto le'isur, we would allow you to move it either letzorach makom, letzorach gufo, because I need the item for a permissible purpose, to crack the nut, or letzorach makomo, I need that space. So for example, Rav Moshe Feinstein spoke about, let's say I want to load up the dishwasher. Not because I want to use the dishwasher on Shabbos, because one certainly is not allowed to use the dishwasher on Shabbos. And even if you have a non-Jew turn the dishwasher on, or you have a Shabbos clock, generally Ashkenazim follow the opinion of the Shulchan Aruch, which is, of the Ramah, that we're not allowed to have items running in our home on Shabbos which make noise, because people might think we turn them on Shabbos, even if they're running on a Shabbos clock, which means, if we have a live-in maid in the house, and she decides that she wants to vacuum the floor after the Shabbos meal, doesn't matter that we didn't ask her to do that, that is something we have to be vigilant about. It's something we're not allowed to have done in our own homes, even though I have nothing to do with the malacha, because that borderlines on the issue of hashma'as kol. You have an item in your house which is doing malacha and making noise, and the person who's passing by your house hears the malacha being done and doesn't know that you're not the one doing it. The same might go with the dishwasher. Nowadays that we have silent dishwashers, which really are silent, this question might change. Maybe we do have a right to put it on a Shabbos clock and have it run on Shabbos. Somebody mentioned last week what I believe is a big mistake. They said, well, what if I set the Shabbos clock with the dishwasher to run at 3 o'clock in the morning when nobody's going to hear it? That doesn't make a difference. It does not make a difference. Because when we're talking about an appliance that makes noise and is doing a malacha, it doesn't matter if it's 3 o'clock in the morning and nobody in your house hears it. There can always be somebody else who hears it. And therefore we assume that would be something we need to be mindful of as well. So that's what we refer to as a kli shemalachto le'isur. I know you said in Israel there are those who feel that you're allowed to. I'm not sure what it's all about. It could be, I said last week, it could be it's Svardim, but you said they're Ashkenazim. I don't know what the heter is. I looked into it further. I'm not sure what the permissibility is for that. Good, good. No, questions are good. Yeah? Alarm clock is a very great question. An alarm clock is a really good question. How do we have an alarm clock go on Shabbos if that should be the same as Hashma'as Kol? How do I have an appliance that makes noise on Shabbos? The general answer that's given to an alarm clock, my father said he's been bothered by an alarm clock for his whole life and he never understood what the real answer is. But the answer that's given, whether you accept it or not, is everybody knows that that's the nature of an alarm clock. Everybody knows you didn't turn the alarm clock on Shabbos. The nature of an alarm clock is that it was set before Shabbos and now it's going off. So my father happens to be uncomfortable with it, and that's why in my parents' home they never had alarm clocks on Shabbos. We always just were expected to get up when we had to be. And once you get used to it, you get used to it. However, an alarm clock generally we assume, I think most assume that it's permissible, because the assumption is an alarm clock is something that is set before Shabbos and everybody knows that. There's nobody who's going to doubt that you probably turned it on Shabbos. That's not really a reasonable assumption for people who are walking by your home. Now take for example, we spoke about it last night, and this is a challenge that people have who go away to a hotel. What do you do when you're away in a hotel for Shabbos and they don't have an accommodation for your key? So they have the electronic keys in the door and you don't have an option to get a Shabbos key. So what is one supposed to do? Now, one very easy way to deal with it, which might not be the desirable way, is to tape up the door. Problem is, I have clothing in the room, I have jewelry in the room, I don't want somebody coming into my room and stealing my things that I have. So you'll say, you'll put it in the safe. Now that works if you're in a hotel, maybe it works, I don't know, but maybe it works if you're in a hotel where you're the only Orthodox Jew there, you're the only one pulling this shtick and taping up your door, so you're assuming nobody's going to happen to notice the one door in the hotel that happens to be taped up. What if you're in a program for Pesach where you have 500 rooms and every single room is taped up, and now everybody's sitting at the Seder? All you need is one wise guy to walk around the hotel and clear everybody out in one night. Correct? So what does one do under those circumstances? Now, we would hope that whoever's making a Pesach program would figure out how to do it in a place where they have a key that could accommodate, but that's not always the case. Sometimes you have a convention and they don't always have an accommodation. So what do? Well, let's just get off the bat. One certainly is not allowed to take the key and put it in the door. That would certainly be a malacha. There's nothing to talk about that. You're certainly not allowed to do that. You're completing a circuit by doing that. You're having the lights go on and off, the green and the red. Certainly something you would not be allowed to do on Shabbos on your own. However, when you have a program like that, we assume that you're allowed to have a non-Jew who can open the door for you. That is considered a amira lenachri. You're asking a non-Jew to do it for you, b'makom mitzvah, because you're going on this program in order to celebrate Pesach, in order to learn Torah, in order to do whatever you're doing. So that would be something that we would generally permit. The question is, how exactly should that be done? So there are two ways that hotels do this. I'm sure many of us have seen this before. No? I assume. So sometimes you have the following system worked out, and that is you have a non-Jew on every floor, and when they see somebody walking toward their door, they'll follow them, and they'll open the door for them. Now, how do they open the door? In some circumstances, they open the door because they have a master electronic key, and they just go to every door, and anyone who's standing by the door, they open it. That's best case scenario. Sometimes they expect you to have your own key, and then they're just standing on the floor available, and then when you get there, you're going to give them your card, and they'll put it in for you and give it back to you. Is that card key considered to be muktza on Shabbos? What would you say? So here's what I believe is a fascinating question. What category of muktza would you put that card in? What would you say? Muktza machmas iser. What would you say? It's a klisha malachta le'iser? Why? Because the only purpose that you have for it is to do something you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. Correct? That's what I would have said. Rabbi Belsky argued, the OU had a big discussion about this because they certify hotels, and part of the discussion about whether or not they're allowed to certify a hotel is everything in the hotel up to our standard for Shabbos? So this was a major discussion they had. Are we allowed to certify a hotel that only has electronic keys? How are people going to work around the issue? Well, Rabbi Belsky in the OU, my father felt, it's a klisha malachta le'isr. You don't have a right to carry it around with you. You have to have the system where the non-Jew stands on the floor with a electronic key that is a master electronic key, and he has to be the one to open the door. However, Rabbi Belsky argued, no, I would be allowed to carry around my key myself and have the non-Jew take it from me. Why? Because he said... No, money's not a factor. That's not a factor. Muktzah is not allowed just because you're going to lose money. The Gemara even goes so far as to say, forgetting about muktzah for a minute, let's say a person sees their whole house burning down, and there's no issue of sakana. Right? There's no issue of sakana, which today is irrelevant, because there's always a sakana, because our homes are so close to one another. If there's a fire in someone's house, it could very easily spread somewhere else. But let's say you live out somewhere all by yourself, and there's a fire in the house, and the fire station is all around, and it's not going to spread. Let's say, in theory, even though I know my entire house is going up in smoke, and I'm going to lose everything I ever had, it's a tremendous hefsid merubah, I'm not allowed to put it out on Shabbos. And one is also not allowed to violate the laws of muktzah just because I'm going to lose money. So that's not a heter. What is the heter? Said Rabbi Belsky, maybe we should assume it's permissible because of the following, and this is brilliant. He said maybe it's permissible because one should consider the fact that that is what we would refer to as litzarech gufo. The same way I'm allowed to take a hammer on Shabbos because I want to crack open a nut, which is permissible, so too he said, Since I'm allowed to ask the non-Jew to open the door for me, I'm also allowed to carry around the key to give to the non-Jew. That's what we call letzarach gufo. Now, the OU disagreed with Rabbi Belsky's opinion, but I think it's something interesting to consider. It's a fascinating point of view. Would we consider the mukta key to be permissible because you want to use it for a permissible purpose which is not really permissible? You're having a non-Jew who's doing everything for you that you wouldn't be allowed to do on your own. I think that's a very interesting application of this rule here. How would we consider that card key? What category would it fall under? Be it as it may, those are basically the review of last week. And now that it's 10:05 and we have 20 minutes left, let's see what we can try and cover today. Any questions so far on what we've discussed? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's always been the employee on the floor, arrangements made ahead of time with the master key.
That's great. That's a wonderful scenario. But that's not always the case, unfortunately.
No, and it's a matter of...
One second. One final point I want to make is a point that you raised last week. You didn't really, but you wanted to raise it, and I read your mind. Someone mentioned about scissors.
Yes.
So... my wife informed me that the easiest way to open an ISIS without making a mess is with scissors. So would you say that a scissors is the same as a hammer? I argued that based on nothing, but I would assume based on whatever we discussed, that a scissors should be the same as the hammer. And a scissors would be permissible because that falls under the category of an item which is usually used only for a prohibited purpose, but now I want to use it for a permissible purpose. The only, however, to that is the following. It's correct. My father agreed. It is correct. You would be allowed to use a scissors. The only, however, to that is the following. The Mishnah Berurah throws some way a monkey wrench into all this, and he says, the only time a kli shemalachta le'iser, the only time a hammer is allowed to be used to crack the coconut is when you don't have very easily accessible something else which can be used instead. So again, if we're talking about an ISIS, the easiest way to open up an ISIS is with the scissors. So you'll say it's very easy to take a knife and open it. Not always the case. Sometimes if you open it with a knife, it's going to make a mess all over the place. You're not mechuyev to do that. You're not obligated to do that. If it's something that's very easy to use the scissors and you don't have to use... I'm sorry, if it's easy to use the knife and it's not going to make a difference, so use the knife. But if you have to use the scissors because otherwise it's going to make a mess or otherwise... it's not going to be able to be, or you're afraid that you're going to cut yourself if you take a knife and you start cutting open the ices, we certainly would permit you to use the scissors because that's a regular example of, it's a classic example of, a kli shemalachta le'iser. Okay? Yeah?
What if we use the scissor that is designated only for food?
Right. So that's like a knife. That's like a knife.
So you could have what this part would say is designated for this part. So you would be able to use that.
Like a chicken shears.
Okay, right.
Correct.
So you could use that to open the ice.
That's correct. Okay, so now let's move forward. Yeah.
What happens if you...
just 1 second, please. Yeah. It's correct, but we assume you're allowed to open the ices because you need the food that's inside. You're allowed to open a bag of potato chips because you need the food that's inside. You're asking, what about the fact that sometimes when you open something, you're going to create a new kli? That's more of a question with regard to opening bottles and cans and things like that, where you're really creating something new, because now the cap that you took off is usable for something else. That's a major question. I think I mentioned last week that I've learned Maseches Beitza with my father four separate times, the entire Masechta beginning to end. And in the middle of Maseches Beitza, there's a discussion about opening bottles and caps. That's where the whole discussion comes from. All four times that I've learned the Masechta with my father, we've learned through that piece of Gemara. And when we finished it, he said, I didn't understand this when I was 20 years old, and I don't understand it when I'm 70 years old. So he says, I don't have an opinion about opening bottles and caps on Shabbos because I don't understand what the sources really mean. That's what my father has told me, and that's why he has taken upon himself not to open bottles and caps, just because he doesn't have, in his opinion, a deep enough understanding of the source itself to formulate an opinion. Now, you'd say it's a strange thing for somebody like my father not to really understand what it means. Okay, but you know, there are a lot of things that even great people don't understand, and I don't know, in his opinion, he feels it's something that you have to be concerned about. Yes?
Yes, you find out the whole problem with the car keys, if he goes to court for
No, he argued with Rabbi Belsky. So the makeup of the OU, for those who don't know, was the OU, when Rabbi Belsky was alive, was made up of three major halachic decisors, and that was Rabbi Belsky, Rabbi Herschel Schechter, and Rabbi Menachem Genach. Usually the way it worked was they had a consensus of two out of the three. So sometimes my father was outvoted, sometimes Rabbi Genach is outvoted, and sometimes Rabbi Belsky was outvoted. Here's one of those cases where Rabbi Belsky was outvoted, and the OU policy, which I have, this is the official OU document, if anyone wants to see it. The OU policy is that they're only allowed to certify a hotel if the arrangement is that they're going to have a non-Jew with a master key or who's going to hold everyone's keys, because they felt that you're not allowed to have the members of the hotel, the Jewish members of the hotel, carrying around their keys. That would be considered muktzah. Now, there's a famous misnomer. I just want to get a little further and then maybe we'll take questions. There's a famous misnomer, and that is sometimes when we see children handling muktzah on Shabbos, we say, don't touch, you're not allowed to touch, it's muktzah. Now, that's a big mistake, because it's not really clear that one is not allowed to touch muktzah. I think really the prohibition in Shulchan Aruch is one is not allowed to move muktzah. So let's just try to understand that. We have a very sensitive area of halacha called a goses. So you have, unfortunately, every so often somebody is in the hospital and they're clearly in the final stages of life. They're clearly on, you know, the last day or the last 2 days. We're not talking about somebody who the doctors say has another 6 months to live. That's not called a goses. A goses means somebody who's at the very, very end of life. And the doctors have told us the systems are failing. They only have another day or two. There's no way the body can sustain itself. And this is it. That's what we call a goses. Now, the Gemara talks about how we are supposed to view a goses. So number one, the Gemara tells us that a goses is considered chai l'chol dabar. A goses is considered to be a live human being for all intents and purposes, which means you have no right to unplug any machines. You have no right to do anything that's going to kill this patient, because we assume that would be called killing the patient. You're not allowed to do anything that's going to take away the life of this person sooner. That's number one. A goses is considered kechai l'chol dabar. That is the way the Shulchan Aruch paskins. That is clear. It becomes a complicated issue, because the Gemara says you're not really allowed to do anything to a goses, because you never know what your activity might cause in the context of the overall medical condition of this patient. So sometimes you have somebody who's at the very final stages of life, unfortunately, and the family wants to give kisses or hugs or hold a hand or caress the person. Or, you know, I was talking this summer with some of the doctors in Camp Simcha, and they said very often, unfortunately, they have pediatric patients who are dying, and the parents just want to take the kid off the bed and hold the kid for the last few minutes of life. And as much as we sympathize with that, as much as it makes a lot of sense, it's very challenging and it's very problematic. And I'm not giving a psak. I would encourage anyone who ever has the circumstance to ask somebody that they trust, because this is something that the Gemara says one has to be very careful about. You might be violating the prohibition of ritzicha, of murder, because you never know what activity that you're doing might hasten the death. Now, if we're talking about a medical professional who knows that by doing this or by doing that, that's not going to affect the death at all, that's a different story. But when we're talking about just family members who really don't know what it is that they might be doing that might cause the condition to go either way, it's something one has to be very, very careful about. My father told me he remembers when my grandfather was in the hospital, and he said a part of his leg went off the bed, and it was the last few hours of his life, and that was clear. He said that he felt very uncomfortable. As much as your instinctive reaction is to put the leg back on, right, to do everything you can to make things look as good as they should, he said he made sure to ask a non-Jewish nurse to come quickly and do whatever had to be done. He didn't want to get involved because, again, this is a very sensitive area of halacha that needs to be thought about very carefully. I have always been very inspired by, there's a 5-volume set of svarim for anyone who's a doctor or whose spouse or children might be doctors. It's a very beautiful set of svarim. I happen not to feel that the psukim that are written there are always correct, which is fine. You don't always have to agree with everybody. My father feels many of them are incorrect, but it's a beautiful set of svarim for a different reason. There's a 5-volume set of svarim called Shi'urei Torah L'Rofim, which is a 5-volume set of books that's all about questions that came in from doctors. And this, what I find most inspiring about this is that there are so many letters in there that came from doctors from all over the world who really wanted to know the answers to the dilemmas that they were facing. So there's a doctor in Tel HaShomer who he writes, he's a doctor penimai. I guess that means you're an intern, right? An internist. What? What? A general internist. So he was doing a round on the emergency ward one fine afternoon, and he says he's in Tel HaShomer in Ramat Gan, And he writes a letter that he has a patient that came in, and she was she had a heart attack, and she was mechuseret hakara, which means she was already unconscious. He said she had a liver failure, so there was no way to fix that. Her kidneys were now failing as well. It was clear to him that she was a gozis, that there was just all the systems were failing, there was nothing they could do to save her, unless they can save her in the short term just to give her another couple of minutes or hours of life, but there was nothing really that they can do beyond that. As this was going on, they were trying to figure out what to do with her. She started having an epileptic attack. And part of that was she was having seizures and her mouth was going out of control and her arms were flying out of control. So he, as a doctor, felt that his responsibility is to give her Valium in order to calm her and that the body should just relax. So that's what he did. He started to get it ready. He was about to put it in the IV and the husband started yelling, "My wife is a ghost, so you don't have a right to do anything." The Gemara says you don't have a right to touch her, you don't have a right to do anything. So he said, "So why'd you bring her into the hospital?" Obviously, you expected that we were going to do something. So he presented his question, and the truth is it's a very serious question. What is a doctor supposed to do, even if you're a medical professional? On the one hand, the Gemara says, leave the ghostess alone. On the other hand, you can't just leave the ghostess alone. You're coming to the hospital means you want to be treated. So what do we have a right to do and what do we not? And he said, how could I be comfortable just allowing the person to be sitting there with their hands flopping up and down and their mouth opening up and, you know, opening wide and closing and not do anything for them because the patient is a ghostess? He thought that was unreasonable, and I think he's correct. But again, as we mentioned, this is something that has to be measured very, very carefully should one ever be in the circumstance. Why are we mentioning this with regard to Hilchos Shabbos? The reason we mention it is as follows. The Gemara says, so careful we need to be with regard to how we handle a goses. The Gemara says that one is not even allowed to, you know, sometimes at the end of life, if you've ever been there, unfortunately I have been a few times, so sometimes at the end of life you see that, you know, the eyes roll back. It's not a scene that's very comfortable for people to see. And the Gemara says that sometimes instinctively a person, just for the dignity of the person who's the patient, sometimes for their dignity you would want to close their eyes just so people shouldn't have to look at them in that way. So the Gemara says, Ein matzimav, ein av shel hames. You're not allowed to close the eyes of a person who's in that final stage of death because you never know. Even by doing such a small act of closing an eyelid, of an eyelid or something, you never know, maybe that's going to affect the condition in some negative way. That's what the Gemara says. What about on Shabbos when you have a patient that actually died and we know that the patient is no longer alive and now the practice is we close the eyes before burial? So would one be allowed if somebody, Rachmana Litzlan, passes away on a Shabbos and now you're just sitting in the house and, you know, you're doing whatever you're doing, saying Tehillim, I don't know what you're doing, but you want to close the eyes because you just don't want to have to look at a face like that. So the Gemara says that would be considered to be Muktzah on Shabbos. You're not allowed to close the eyes of somebody who passed away on Shabbos because that would be considered to be muktzah. And the Rishonim ask, what have I done? I haven't taken the body and picked it up and moved it somewhere else. All I did was I did a very small action to just close an eyelid. But the Rishonim say what you see from here is that muktzah means you're not allowed to move something. Even if it doesn't mean that you're going to move it from place A to place B, but even if it's going to be partially moved, that is something that is not permissible. However, if it's something that is not going to be moved at all, the Rishonim say, if it's just negiya b'muktza, that is permissible. And that stems from another very important Gemara. So for example, there's something that comes up very often in the summer, and that is the use of trees on Shabbos. So sometimes we have a tree house, and kids like to go up on the trees, or adults like to go up and play with them, or you have a more common example, a hammock. People like to relax on the tree, right? The hammock is not on the tree, but it's somehow connected to the tree. What is our perspective with regard to doing that on Shabbos? So, the story begins as follows. The Gemara says in Maseches Erevin, Ein olam ba'ilan. You're not allowed to climb up on a tree on Shabbos. You're not allowed to be mishtamesh ba'ilan b'Shabbos. You're not allowed to use a tree for your own purpose on Shabbos. Why not? What's wrong? The Gemara says we're concerned. Maybe in the course of whatever you're doing, you're going to end up breaking off a branch. And that would be a very serious prohibition on Shabbos. You're not allowed to break off branches on Shabbos. Therefore, says the Gemara, stay far away from the trees. You're not allowed to use them. You're not allowed to climb on them. Trees are off limits on Shabbos. Now, the Gemara tells us, however, that although you're not allowed to use a tree, you're allowed to indirectly use a tree on Shabbos, as long as it's once removed from the tree. Okay? So therefore, take, for example, the common example of a hammock. So you have a hammock. Generally, sometimes you have two different ways that it can be connected to a tree. Sometimes you can have just a rope that's tied around the tree. I happen never to be comfortable. I'm not so heavy. But what if that rope gets loose and you're on the ground? So I'm more comfortable when you have a hammock in general that is connected, let's say, to a bolt on the tree, right? Let's say you have a bolt screwed into the tree, and then you tie the rope to the bolt. Now, I assume many of them are like that, or you have a big, heavy screw on the tree, and now this is tied onto that. Is that generally the way it's done? I don't know. Some are like this, some are like that. So it makes a difference for Shabbos. The Gemara says, if it's tied directly onto the tree, you're not allowed to make use of it on Shabbos, because that's called being mishtamish be'ilan. You're using a tree, and you're not allowed to use a tree. However, if it's what we call tzidei tzedadin, meaning it's twice removed, so you have the rope that is connected to the bolt, and the bolt is connected to the tree, then we assume that that would be permissible, because you're not directly using the tree, you're indirectly making use of the tree, and that would be allowed. However, says the Mishnah Berurah, that is all wonderful if you're going to sit on the hammock and it's not going to make the trees move as you sway on it. But if the trees are going to move while you're sitting on it, then that is a violation of muksa, because trees are off limits on Shabbos. And therefore, since we assume trees are off limits on Shabbos, if you're talking about something, either you're too heavy and therefore the tree is going to move, or it's the kind of tree that's not so stable, not so sturdy, which maybe you shouldn't be using for a hammock anyway, but if it's going to sway at all, then we assume that would be something that we would not allow on Shabbos, because that would be considered handling muktzah on Shabbos, which you're not allowed to do. A common case that comes up is, what if you have a ball? You know, kids are playing with a ball, and now the ball goes into the tree on Shabbos. So what do we do about that? No one ever had the problem? All right, so what do we do about that? So the Shmir Shabbos Kilchasa discusses that issue, and he says the following. Shmir Shabbos Kilchasa tells us that kadur shenafal al ha'ilan, if you have a ball that goes into a tree on Shabbos, aser lehorido misham b'Shabbos v'yamtiv, you're not allowed to either climb up onto the tree to take it down. That's a prohibition of being mishtamish b'ilan. You're also not allowed to use a makal. You're not allowed to take a stick, either a broomstick, and push it out of the tree. Why? Because that's just an extension of your hand, and maybe you're going to go and break a branch vicariously while you're doing that. Then he even has a discussion, what if somebody does it? What if somebody does what they weren't supposed to do? They take a broom and they go hit it out of the tree. Am I even allowed to use it after it comes out? So there's probably room to be makel. But in general, he says, one should be careful not to go onto the tree to take it down, or to take any kind of utensil to take it down, because that would be a serious problem of muktzah, of being mishtamish be'ila. Now again, this is something to be aware of, because we have to be careful that when we use a hammock, when we do something like that, we would have to make sure that the tree is not going to move on Shabbos. Now let's say, take for example, I'm walking on Shabbos, taking a beautiful walk in the summer Shabbosos, and I get a rock in my shoe. Happens every so often. And now it's very annoying, and there's no bench for me to sit down on, and I don't want to take my shoes off and put my bare foot onto the ground while I'm shaking out the shoe. So what do I do? What do most people do? Lean on a tree. So generally, when I lean on a tree, there's nothing to worry about. It's not going to start moving just because I'm leaning on the bark of the tree. Sometimes there is no tree there. So what do I do then? Lean on a car. Now, leaning on a car would probably be the same thing. Usually, when you just put some weight on a car, the car is not really going to move as a result of what you're doing. And that's where the Achronim say there would be no problem if you need to, because you need to shake out your foot, or because you need to take a rest, and you just need to lay, you know, to put your weight onto something else. We would not consider that to be a problem of muksa. And that's what I believe is a famous misnomer. Very often when children are touching something, so we say, it's muksa, the answer is, it's not muksa to touch something that you're not allowed to use on Shabbos. It's muksa to move something that you're not allowed to use on Shabbos. And therefore, we have to be careful when we tell our children what it is that they're allowed to do and what it is that they're not. My father always told us as parents, but he told us as when we were children growing up as well, you always have to be honest with your kids. Don't tell them something is usher if it's not. And don't exaggerate, because he said someday they're going to grow up and find out that you were wrong. And someday they're going to find out that you were exaggerating things, and then you're going to come out losing everything. So he always encouraged us to tell our children the truth. And as parents, my parents always told us the truth. One famous example that he always likes to tell us, every year before Pesach when I call him, he says, don't lie to your kids and say that Eliyahu HaNavi drank from the cup. It bothers him. He said every year it bothered him when schools tell the kids that, oh, Eliyahu HaNavi, look, and you see something spilled out of the cup. He said it's a total lie. We know it's not true. That's not what Kosa Shel Eliyahu means. And he said at some point our kids are going to grow up and they're going to say our parents lied to us and it wasn't true. And who knows what else they lied about. And my father always encourages us to do that. And I feel when it comes to the laws of Muktzah as well, yes, it's much easier to tell our kids, don't touch this, don't touch that. You're not allowed to, you know, be near this. You can't touch the radio. You can't touch the alarm clock. It's much easier for us because it just keeps us away from problems. But it's not the absolute truth. It's not really true. It's not true that we're not allowed to touch muktzah. It's rather, they're not allowed to move muktzah. You're not allowed to handle muktzah. And therefore, we have to be careful with how we give that over to the youth as well. Yeah?
I